Hello, I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, my guest today is Bridget Bard, the founder and CEO of Biosure, helping the country return to normality with its rapid COVID-19 testing. When the world was disrupted by the pandemic last year, Biosure moved quickly, having already pioneered the exact technology that could help with the first easy-to-use at-home self-test kit for HIV. With a mission to give people confidence and control over their own health, Biosure is paving the way for groundbreaking innovation in the medical space. Bridget, welcome to Changemakers. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, not least because you and I actually spoke in an interview about a year ago, just over a year ago, when you were very much focused on Biosure as a business for HIV. Today, obviously, we're talking about Biosure and the pandemic, your role in providing that kind of self-testing environment in the home. Tell us a little bit more about the business. Introduce us to it.
Oh, hello, Michael. I'm delighted to see you again. And goodness me, what a difference a year makes. It really does. So as you were saying, so Biosure fundamentally was founded on the principles of self-testing. So we developed and launched the first blood-based HIV self-test anywhere. Could not have chosen anything more difficult to do. But the learning that we've done in the 5 years before the pandemic hit has really put us in an incredibly strong position with regards to self-testing. So we've pivoted our expertise now and adapted our HIV self-test to now look for antibodies for COVID. So yeah, it's been an interesting year for everyone, I think.
I remember when we spoke, you used the phrase self-testing is the future. I remember sat there and thinking, well, I guess for people with certain illnesses and certain conditions, that may be the case. But the idea that it would be a society-wide issue, I mean, you called it right. And especially as we enter the next phase of our relationship with the pandemic, it feels like self-testing is going to become very much that future. I mean, tell us a little bit about how you've been innovating that environment and I guess what we can expect to happen next.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always say we didn't invent self-testing because pregnancy testing, home pregnancy testing has been around for, you know, the last 30 years. But that journey where now a woman would never expect to have time off work, go to a doctor, explain why she's had sex, unprotected sex, wait 5 days for a result, it's a no-brainer. And the home pregnancy testing is globally accepted now. And I think we were in that in-between space when we were pushing kind of, you know, self-testing for other diagnostics. But now with COVID, it's, you know, I think everyone now is so used to self-testing, you know, school children, and you want to see your friends or your grandparents. So really the whole empowerment angle, taking responsibility, is kind of where we're pushing. And our antibody, our people's test, which will let you know your own immunity status for COVID, is really now our next kind of step in this empowerment journey.
So the people's test is a blood-based test, I believe, where you actually are able to understand your prevalence of antibodies and your understanding of the nature of risk.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, we've always worked with very small blood samples. So it is, I mean, 2.5 microliters doesn't mean a lot to anyone, but a very small drop of blood is 5 microliters. People are obviously, everyone knows something about testing now, but the free tests that the government are giving away to kind of, you know, your twice a week testing to test for the antigen to see if you have infection now. Once you've had infection or once you've had an immune response from the vaccine, your body produces antibodies. So our test will detect if you've got the neutralizing antibodies in your blood. But what that enables you to do is then make more informed choices. People are always concerned about behavior. If someone finds out that they do have neutralizing antibodies, will they suddenly start, you know, ignoring rules or taking extraordinary risks? And we know, certainly from working with HIV, that people are really in charge of their own choices and their own behavior. They don't suddenly go, you know, bananas because they've got
completely hedonistic. It's all fine.
Exactly.
Although I have to say, I mean, we were working just last week on a big event in Liverpool, the Good Business Festival, where, you know, this was one of the first of the big test events where people had self-tested before going in. And the thing that my colleagues told me about that was that it was an emotional moment, that ability to be back together again. I mean, you know, your work is about products, about personal freedom, isn't it, as well, and our ability to sort of, like, you know, live our lives.
I passionately believe, I mean, that is literally the core of our business. It is enabling people to have more choice, to have more freedom, and to take control. And this behavioral piece, especially around antibody testing, is not necessarily for the people who know that they do have antibodies. It's especially essential for people who don't have antibodies, so that they do know to, you know, really make sure that they take all the protective measures. But knowledge for me is power. And to not have access, it's your choice if you choose to test the same as everything is, but you need to have the choice available to you so you can make your own decisions on the right basis.
That phrase, knowledge is power, it feels like this is the moment where that feels so right, so true. And I mean, you mentioned obviously kind of pregnancy self-testing as being the closest that many people have come to a kind of mass understanding of the very principle of self-testing. But of course, what we're now facing is something which feels, I guess, exponentially different in the sense that it is just something that everyone, everywhere will go through, irrespective of the lives that they live, because of the nature of the ever-present risk of coronavirus. A lot of scientists and innovators that I interview are out there in terms of the innovations that they are able to deliver. To what degree do you think society has kept up with the sorts of innovations that people like you are delivering? And is there a gap to close in terms of how we prepare for this next chapter in this very uncertain future?
Yeah, I mean, I think there really is. And there's still lots of education. Just, I mean, now everyone understands testing and everyone understands lateral flow, but they don't. Lateral flow applies to all of these tests, whether they're pregnancy tests or COVID antigen tests, or, you know, they apply to everything. But I think now that, thank goodness, we're coming back to some normality, and especially integrating intergenerational meetings with weddings and seeing grandparents, and then you're going back into workplace, international travel is looking to, you know, reopen imminently. I think people having an understanding of how their bodies are, how their immunity is, where they are in regards to, you know, their current vaccinations. The whole educational process of this for me is something we've had to adopt. There's not been a choice. And I think everyone's still very numb from how rapidly this happened. You know, within a space, I think, of 6 weeks of us last meeting, there was no COVID. No one had heard of it particularly. It was something possibly in China. And then we were in lockdown. So I think, you know, we've all changed with how we're working, and, you know, everyone talks on Zoom every day. The educational process has still got to roll out with this taking control and making the right choices.
A lot of people will say that alongside that rapid change has come a change in mindsets, especially with our institutions, where I suppose you might well say that, you know, a lot of them were typified by the mitigation of risk rather than the pursuit of opportunity, if you will. I mean, a lot of those guardrails seem to have come off in just the way that, you know, the way we've digitized GP appointments, the way that health has had to respond so quickly to the nature of this change, and obviously learn along the way. In terms of where that mindset is now, I mean, we're talking in the summer of 2020, or the beginning of the summer of 21. Do you think that the opportunity is understood by the institutions in the way that, I guess, entrepreneurial innovators like yourselves are getting a real sense of, actually, we could really change things? Does that view carry?
I think we've definitely been in an example of where if you throw enough money at something, you can make something stick. For me, there's still a great deal more learning to be done of how we've coped, certainly with the first 6 months of this pandemic and the response across the board. Obviously, NHS frontline has been spectacular. But now I think the time for learning of what we could have done better, where it could have been done more cost effective, and then mapping that out into the rest of healthcare is an opportunity that we've actually, there's always an opportunity in everything. And as tough as this has been, there are opportunities to be presented. So I think institutionally, and as you say, moving to digital online, self-testing for me, where If you've got an overstretched NHS, why would you be testing everyone and screening through that process? Surely you get people to self-screen and then engage with healthcare when it's essential. So I think all of those learnings will be implemented on the back of this.
So trust has got to develop.
Trust, I think, on a micro and a macro level. So people trusting themselves to take the control and deal with the information that they have at hand, you know, whether that's with an HIV diagnosis, or if you've got a cold, do you test yourself for COVID? Or if you're going to see grandparents, do you test for antibodies? And then on the macro level, of the institutions trusting people to make the right choices, you know, and I think that disjunct, which possibly wouldn't have happened without this pandemic, is going to be one of the positive things that come out of this.
Yeah, I mean let's stick with positive, because I think that is a word I would use to describe you, Bridget. I mean, you are a phenomenally positive, optimistic person. You know, I note for the benefit of listeners is that behind Bridget's interview station is a poster saying, be bold. I mean, that speaks, I think, to your journey into this. I mean, you know, you've taken an entrepreneurial rather than a scientific route into this world. I mean, does that make you an exception, or are you now increasingly the rule, do you think, in terms of that attitude, that style?
Yeah, well, I think in the diagnostic sector, I'm still kind of the exception rather than the rule, because I think most people that are in this industry have grown up in it and understand it. As you say, I came in completely from the side, really fundamentally on the belief of self-testing, but it's not been an easy journey. And I would say that it was very lucky I came into this as naive as I was, because I'm not sure with hindsight I could have kind of, you know, delivered what we've delivered. But I think I said this before, we say when a door shuts, we'll climb through a window, and the whole company, we're still a lean, nimble team delivering, packing a punch way above where we should. So yeah, possibly we're still the exception.
So let's go back to that, you know, startup sort of position for you in terms of what, why, you know, you say self-testing was the thing that interested you. I mean, open that up for us in terms of explaining what got you into this area and indeed what drives the passion.
Well, I don't know who's seen our test and who hasn't. Hopefully when the COVID antibody test is around, a lot more people will have seen it. But the plastic device that we use, which is the really clever bit that kind of only requires a tiny drop of blood, we didn't invent that. So I was introduced to the man who had the patent for that, and we were talking, and I just thought, wow, this is absolutely amazing. You know, this is a no-brainer. You can test for all diseases with a tiny drop of blood. Wow. So it kind of started from there. As I say, this, the discretion side of things, the convenience, the ownership are all the things that initially drew me to that. But obviously, as we've expanded and we've gone into, you know, international markets, and especially in countries like South Africa, so HIV is my absolute passion, and I firmly believe we have got a role, or we are playing a role.
Why is it the passion? Because, you know, what one thing you could say about the business is that without AIDS, without HIV, that actually, you know, we probably wouldn't be benefiting in the pandemic in the way that we are, in terms of that pioneering research and innovation that you were able to achieve there. Why HIV?
I think because there is such extraordinary stigma around it, and we have given ourselves an opportunity to change how people think and feel. And for me, the behavioural piece is the most interesting and exciting. It's really amazing someone has the tool that they can diagnose themselves or test themselves, but what do they do with that result? How do they feel about that result? How do they own it? And HIV has 100% mortality, so when we're comparing it to COVID, you know, it's just literally chalk and cheese. However, HIV is totally treatable now. So if you test, and going back to kind of Tedros and his WHO speech, I think last April, test and test again. If we were doing that with HIV and we got people on treatment, there would be no transmission and HIV would end. But instead of that, there were 1.7 million new cases last year, which is just the most incredible burden. And people won't test because they're frightened or because of the stigma and all of the connections around HIV, you know, through having unprotected sex or having relationships that people aren't comfortable with. And I'm talking more, you know, kind of culturally in lower income countries. They stop people knowing their status. And if we can just make people feel confident about owning that, we can get the positive people on treatment and keep the negative people negative, and we make a difference. We stop something.
Do you think there are learnings from the, I guess, the early years of AIDS in terms of the societal response, especially in that kind of 80s and 90s period where, you know, I mean, that was for me my kind of coming of age sort of like period where it was the ever-present, you know, sort of ominous risk. There was, you know, that, as you say, there was the issue of 100% mortality. And so that sense of fear was massive. And of course, the journey to empowerment, to treatments, and ultimately testing. I mean, do you see parallels in the relationship with COVID that knowledge may well turn out to have the same empowerment?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it a lot here, and obviously we're in a different era. I think, so there was a real lack of information was the first thing. So a person in one country didn't know what was going on in another country. And now obviously we've got social media and, you know, that media generally is very different. But I do think that there was probably not the global response that we have had to COVID. And that's how things got very out of control. It affected, it was obviously has had much, much bigger impact in lower income countries. Sub-Saharan Africa has borne the bulk of the burden on this. But I think with COVID, there's been a global response. And I think that was very fragmented with HIV and AIDS. There was not this unity, and it's taken a long time to get to the point. And we're still not in a point of a total global response, really, with HIV.
Mm. I mean, one of my past guests was the climate activist Arizona Muse, and she quoted, you know, a well sort of, I guess, sort of publicized phrase that climate needs COVID's publicist in the sense that COVID has, it captures the imagination in the sense of peril and risk, and, you know, for good reason, I guess, in terms of the global experience. But in terms of your understanding, your own experience in terms of how you turn that sense of a lack of control, a loss of control, into something which allows us to feel empowered. I mean, are above and beyond the medical side to this, what are the other things that are the triggers or the clues that you'd point to?
Well, I do think the behavioural piece. So even when we were in our development phases with the HIV test, I was working with anthropologists, which I find fascinating about how human emotion can impact someone so much. When we came to market, we know that through testing, we find people who have got HIV, and we know how to signpost those people and to get them into treatment and support. But what we hadn't kind of taken on board is the impact we can take on keeping people negative. So generally, when someone is going to test, they're surrounded by negative emotions. They are frightened of the result. They might be ashamed of something that they've done. They wish they hadn't done something. And then they start to take ownership. And they take control of it, and they go through that kind of 15 minutes of waiting, which I know feels like a lifetime. And when somebody comes out with a negative result, they think, right, I am on top of this. Now I'm not going through it. Yeah, I'm not going through this again. I'm gonna own this. I'm gonna take control. I'm gonna make the choices that are right for me because I've got more information to make them with. And it is an empowerment thing. And I think with the COVID pandemic, we're all ready now to kind of start taking that responsibility and that ownership back. And where things have been very suppressed for a long time, and there is more information coming through, whether it's about immunity or reopening society, I think individually we're ready to start taking those steps forward.
And you see, I've interviewed you now twice, and the thing that I've always taken out of our conversations is that there is a huge issue of social empowerment for you, that actually there are, you know, this is as much about the social as it is about the science. I mean, it's no surprise, I think, that on your lockdown list that accompanies this episode, that, you know, your reading is things like Hans Rosling, the Factfulness author, that, you know, that the idea that you can take control, that there is, you know, an inherent positivity to you. I also noticed that your best tip for life was remember to breathe. Tell us about what fuels that, you know, that sort of that positivity. What gets you up in the morning, Bridget, in terms of that kind of that effervescent energy?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I had completely underestimated the tangible social impact that we've had. And I've always felt incredibly privileged to run a company where we get emails on social media messages, and every single day people saying thank you to us. And I mean, we've seen, obviously, everyone's been through a real sort of journey of mental health during lockdown. And we've seen around HIV, people's anxiety really spike. And it's where there's more time and there's, you know, because there's more fear. But I do think this ownership, I've become quite addicted to making people feel in control of the journeys that they take. And I have to say, as I've got older, I've understood that this is all about the journey. This is not about the result.
And your journey is a journey about making a difference, right? Isn't it? I mean, so everything you've just said there, I think confirms that, is that, you know, you're motivated by the difference you can make in people's lives, by that ability to live lives that are more positive and more hopeful. Let's go back a bit, though. You know, if I said remove the business and to remove the burning platform of the issue of the day, what drives that in you, do you think, in terms of why your life outlook is as it is?
Yeah, I used to think I was terrified of failure, and I'm not sure I am now, because we've been through a lot over. Barshaw's 10 years old this year, so we still feel like a startup. But I'm not sure I am terrified of failure. I just want to give it my best shot. I think that's the driving force. And if for some reason it doesn't work, it can't be my responsibility of what happens. I've tried my best. And that's, I think, quite core in me. Maybe it's an older sibling thing.
Well, let's talk about family, because you mentioned that your biggest inspiration was your grandmother. Tell us about her.
Yeah, and it's strange because I was trying to think of, I couldn't think of any sort of kind of famous people who are kind of my inspiration. But my grandmother's played such a role in my life. And the thing that she taught me that I hope I kind of filter out, certainly through my children, but anyone who I get an opportunity to say, is that she taught me you only have to sleep with one person your whole life. You have to put your head on the pillow and be comfortable with yourself, because if you're not, then, you know, you're doing something wrong. And, you know, during the day, if you do something wrong, or you think you get away with something, or you wish you hadn't done something, you have to make peace with that, I think, and make yourself better from that understanding.
And I read that you said that she, you know, she taught you how to love unconditionally. I mean, tell us a little bit about that, and about how can you take that kind of very centrally emotional and noble human quality and use it more generally in your life?
I think that is so good. I think I was adored by her as a child. So I do know what that unconditional love and kindness feels like. And I think what that kind of has probably enabled me to do, and I hope it's the same with my children, is to be quite fearless. So it doesn't matter how much love you give to someone, it's your emotion to give out, and to not feel disappointed by people who don't reciprocate that. Maybe it's a self-respect element, that you're comfortable in giving out the things you give without expecting anything in return.
How far can you extend that, though? Because I think, I mean, everybody listening will go with it, I'm sure, in terms of, right, okay, you've got to be kinder to yourself, you've got to, you know, be a loving partner, a loving parent, you know, a loving friend. I mean, when you start to take this into the world of your day-to-day business life, how kind or how cruel is the world of business, do you think, from the way that you see it?
Yeah, so that's where the remember to breathe bit comes in. So remember that things are positive, remember that kindness is key. And I think the whole community element of kind of COVID has brought that to the forefront. I think we deal on such individual levels. So we deal directly with consumers. And I so want that individual person to feel good about the choices they've made, even if they've been mistakes, because they've learned from something. And then we sort of ratchet right the way up to government and the World Health Organization. And it's not that different, much bigger walls to kind of try and knock down, not always successfully. But I think it is giving it your best shot, so that you do know at the end of the day that you've done the best you could do.
What was your take on AstraZeneca's decision to not to make profit out of the pandemic? I mean, did you see that as being, you know, reflective of the good business in this instance?
I think it certainly is. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all commercial enterprises, and we've got to keep the light bulbs on. But, you know, taking advantage of what is an awful global position is essential. And from my reckoning, I would rather, which is probably quite controversial, but that actually we overpaid for tests in high income countries, so that we can make sure lower income countries have the same time, the same access as us. I would sleep easier at night doing that.
People like Gordon Brown, the former UK Prime Minister, and Mary Robinson, the former Irish leaders, they've all been making this point that, you know, there's been a billion vaccines. The vast majority of those have gone to countries in the Northern Hemisphere. I mean, do you think that when we look back on this, that we may be in danger now of saying we let a lot of people on the planet down in terms of the way we just galvanized our innovation, our capital, our ideas to actually make the difference when we had the chance?
Yeah, I do. I genuinely feel that. So we've got a company, we've got BioSure South Africa, and obviously we set up a company in South Africa because of the HIV burden that the country bears. But there's less than 1 million COVID vaccines that have been distributed across the country. We know that HIV treatments, people have had less access to treatments. There's no condom programs running. Healthcare generally is much poorer. You know, we're vaccinating down to, you know, far younger ages now. We're talking about vaccinating our children, whereas there are countries that actually have vulnerable populations that I just feel we could be supporting more. And at the end of the day, you know, I was on a plane backwards and forwards to South Africa every other month before lockdown. And now it's like, well, you know, you don't count anymore. I might come and see you. Tough luck. We're okay here. And I can't bear that approach.
And here we are. It feels like we are at a massive crossroads now globally, where we are seeing vaccines and self-testing being rolled out on an industrial scale. Some people feel very optimistic about where that might now take us in terms of the not just our ability to deal with the pandemic, but actually our ability to make progress as people in terms of societal progress, economic progress, climate progress. Other people are not so sure. I had a guest on this show that said gratitude is not normally a quality that lasts for very long. And in terms of, you know, the where we go next and how you feel, how easy it will be for people like you, those that want to create that better future to not only survive, but thrive, I guess. I mean, how do those kind of conditions favour you or not?
Well, you know, you do know me. I am eternally optimistic. But I think, look, there have been mistakes that have been made throughout this pandemic, and they're still being made now. But we have got this opportunity to learn. And I think understanding that, and I'm passionate about the kind of climate change element to this as well, because I believe that COVID actually couldn't have taken traction had we not been, you know, destroying environments where animals would live. And, you know, we know that the kind of animal to human leap is generally made because of deforestation and, you know, general climate change. But I think learning through all this, and it's sad to think that gratitude doesn't last too long, but I think we've got to make a push to not forget this. COVID is going to be around for a while, and there will be the next version of COVID whenever that hits. So the most important thing for me to be optimistic about moving forward is learning from our mistakes at this point and not making them again. I think that's the takeaway I would have.
Do you think that if I was to wave a magic wand and you were just starting again, do you think that the pandemic would have made it even more of a certainty that you would have finished up in an area like this? Or do you think you'd be looking at other areas? Because, you know, it strikes me that as a person is that you've got that natural entrepreneurial ability and flair, and, you know, there's something that you could see in a number of different settings. But do you think that actually the pandemic will create a new generation of Bridgets in terms of people that really want to get into that science and innovation area in terms of their career choices, their business choices, that entrepreneurial journey themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I really hope so. I think with the testing side of things, there's been lots of bandits come to town who've you know, bought rubbish tests out of China and thrown them in a box and, you know, made a quick buck off of it. So I think there are lots of those people, but I think we've retained our integrity about how we've approached this. We've kept everything UK based. We've collaborated with, I think, virtually all of the UK manufacturers and test developers, and there has been learning from all sides. So I mean, all you know, disasters always, you know, throw something good forward. And I think the entrepreneurial spirit, I'm an Essex girl, so we're surrounded by entrepreneurs in Essex, but I think people are seeing angles now that they possibly wouldn't have seen in all areas to, you know, start accelerating forwards again.
But yours is a business that has definitely captured the imagination in many ways. I mean, many, many awards. Your latest one is a Queen's Award for Enterprise. In terms of what that says about this area, particularly for you, how you've brought, as you said, a professionalisation to it, you've brought a style and an ambition to it. If you were just to reflect on the what happens next, I mean, is this just the start of the journey on self-testing, do you think? Or is there going to be a point where you just think, actually, this is a mission accomplished moment for a business like us?
Oh, no, definitely not. I think we're right at the beginning of this journey now. And I mean, our ambition, which I hope we've achieved, was to set the bar as high as possible. So for me, establishing BioSure as the trusted, credible self-testing brand has always been my sort of ambition. And I think we've set our footprint now, and we're certainly looking now at our next kind of rollout, not only into sexual health testing, but looking beyond that about how we can start to look at preventative diagnostics as well. Because once something's easy for someone, if someone knows, so we see this especially in the UK, where we've got, you know, subscribers, people test themselves for HIV every 3 months, every 6 months, like going to the dentist.
Easy, socialized, trusted, you just get on with it. Yeah.
So
alas, our time is almost up. So I've got one last question, and I was thinking, well, what do I talk to you about? I mean, your lockdown soundtracks have got Pete Tong on there, Lou Reed. There's lots of good stuff. But I think you've got a lovely quote for life that you described as a very wise friend once said to you. Tell us about it and tell us why it meant and means so much to you.
Well, I have to say this friend is incredibly wise, but I was at a low point and having a sob, as I'm known to do occasionally. And I just said to her, I just can't see how we're going to kind of do this and get through it and what happens. And she said to me, don't worry, it will be all right in the end. And if it's not all right, it's not the end. And it is literally, I've just got goosebumps as I've said it, because it kind of cured me. It got everything back in perspective a bit about, okay, so it's not the end. We can keep moving forwards. And it is really true. It's really a true saying.
What a lovely phrase. And, you know, I've got to say, it's not the end, but it is the end of this episode. So, Bridget Budd, thank you so much for joining me on Changemakers.
Michael, it has been my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.